stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? You. This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. We're not going to be taking your phone calls today. We're doing a live mailbag. How interesting that is. I'll tell you more about that in just a moment here. But we do have a very special program ahead for you because it is Old Home Week. We have Rich Jesse as our producer today. Matt Kabinski is our call screener. Michael McCall handling social media. We can take your calls via YouTube. If you want to ask a question via YouTube, you can put that question in the comments box, and Rich will handle that. You can also shoot us an email if you'd like, and the address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. We can take texts today, so you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, then text us your first name and your brief question, message, and data rates may apply. Now, I won't bore you with all the technical stuff, but just to say we're not going to be taking phone calls today, but we are going to get to a whole bunch of wonderful emails that we've received over the past about a week or so. So, I am Tom Price, along with my partner for 10 years today, Dr. David Anders.
Isn't that something else, Tom?
It really is. 2014, we launched this show. September 2014. Rich, I believe you were our initial producer for that. Yes, indeed. So that is how it rolls. And you know, we've talked about the origins of this program a number of times, but I don't think I've shared that you and I were friends. Our families were very close, like 10 years before this program even started.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I tell people the real genius behind the show is Adrienne.
My right? sweetheart.
Right. Because you know, humorously people say to me, Anders, how do you get into Catholic radio? I say it's very simple. You get a PhD in theology, move 5 miles from the world's largest religious broadcaster, get a job singing in the choir next to the program director's wife. You know. Because I met Adrienne. You know, she was an alto, and I was attempting to make a stab at being a second tenor, and got to know Adrienne, and it was she who said, you know, you should do something for the network, and let's get you on with Marcus Grody, and one thing led to another, and then with the radio business, you know, I was a guest on Catholic Answers Live.
Yes.
And I suppose most people probably just call in on the phone, but because I lived close enough to the network, I was able to come in and do the show live from an actual radio studio with better sound quality.
Yeah.
And who was my on-site local producer but Tom Price?
How about that?
You know, we were sat in the studio on the other side of the building, and I was in one room, you were in the other. And that was my first foray into radio, was with you as a guest on Catholic Answers. And so,
pretty neat.
It's been, in my entire life, I've only met one person that said, when I grew up, I want to work in Catholic media. That was Elena Rodriguez.
Right? Yes.
And everybody else in Catholic media I've met over these years, it's always the same story. It's they did something else with their life, and then circumstances changed and their passions changed, and the next thing you know, they find themselves sort of dipping a toe into Catholic media, and then they get drawn in.
Well, when the Lord calls, we think it's a pretty good idea to follow that call.
It's a good idea to follow that call. And it has been the most rewarding professional experience of my life. And working with you has been absolutely fantastic. Working with we have one amazing producer after another.
I know. And it's just been great.
You know, when we get a new one, I'm always sad that we lose the old one, but then I get a new friend, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the story.
Absolutely. Well, it certainly has been a wonderful relationship with the network. So here's to the next 10, my friend.
All right, fantastic.
So we're going to lead off with a text we received from a listener. Can you tell me what are some venial sins? Can you lay some out there? I mean, it's probably pretty a long list.
Yeah, sure. So the difference between venial sin and mortal sin is a difference in degree, not in kind. So anything that can potentially be a mortal sin, you could have a venial instance of that same sin.
Okay.
So basically, go down your list of 10 commandments, right? Let's take one that would be easy. Thou shalt not steal. Okay. If you steal in a way that really does serious damage to a person's financial stability, reputation, way of life, you know, this, you're really knocking them back a step.
Yeah.
Well, that's mortally sinful because it's a really profound offense against human dignity. You know, if like 99% of the American workforce, you've lifted one ballpoint pen too many from the office supply store, right? That's clearly not the same thing, right? It's the magnitude is not at all the same.
Sure.
And I'm not saying, by the way, that walking off with a ballpoint pen is a venial sin, but I suppose it could be under the right circumstance. And that's the way to think about it. And the same thing with, you know, murder. Jesus says, hey, if you say to your brother, you fool, you've violated that commandment. Well, there's more than one way to say you fool, you know. And obviously killing someone is a really, really grave offense. But, you know, saying to somebody, man, you know, you are a real piece of work and I'm not happy with you. Well, you know, I suppose you could ratchet that up to the mortal level if like you're talking to a child, for example, and your harsh words really wound them to the core of their personality in a way that's kind of irreparable.
Yeah.
But normally, you know, kind of a losing your temper sort of thing, same category of sin. It's still this sort of violent assault on a human being, but it's just very, very different in magnitude. So on so with adultery, with bearing false witness. If you perjure yourself, say, in a capital murder trial, obviously much graver than answering dishonestly when your great aunt asks you what you think of her hat.
Yeah, very good. So thank you so much for that text. Here's a quick question from Pat in Tyler, Texas, wondering how Matthew found out about Jesus' 40 days in the desert and his conversion or conversation with Satan after his baptism. I always thought Jesus was alone in the desert.
You're right. Well, you know, he didn't have a drone, I'll tell you that for sure. You know. So if we know something about Jesus' private life, it can only be because he told the disciples.
Okay, so he shared that with them.
That's the only way they could know that, right?
Very good. Pat in Tyler, Texas, thanks so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to come back and bring you a whole bunch of wonderful emails that we've received over the past couple of weeks, and we're going to do that on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. By the way, text lines are open. You can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Back in a moment with lots more Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's Call to Communion on EWTN. This is our 10th anniversary show. We've got some wonderful, wonderful emails to share with you over the next hour or so, so be sure to stay with us. And like we say, if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com. We can also take your text today. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. We'll lead off with the text in just a moment. Let me tell you about a great book. I'm really looking forward to reading this myself. Oasis, Conversion Stories of Hollywood Legends by Mary Claire Kendall. A great read, the new and improved edition of this book. She highlights stories of recovery and conversion in the lives of Hollywood legends whose work has provided such joy to countless souls, but whose real-life stories of struggle, often tragedy, reveal their deepest humanity. Some found solace in the Catholic faith with deathbed conversions, while others underwent a gradual process of conversion. Features are stories of the legendary Alfred Hitchcock, Gary Cooper, Bob Hope, John Wayne, Jane Wyman, Lana Turner, many, many more. It's a fascinating book, Oasis, Conversion Stories of Hollywood Legends. It's available now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic. EWTNRC.com. So here's a text from Brian that just came in the last couple of minutes. He says, a happy 10th anniversary. If a previous Catholic who becomes Protestant seeks to marry a Catholic in the Catholic Church, is the marriage valid?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question.
Did you get all that?
Yeah. So okay. You've got someone who is communing in a Protestant church, but they are canonically Catholic.
Yes.
And they want to marry a Catholic in a Catholic church. Yeah, from the Catholic Church's point of view, All right, so you've got one practicing Catholic here, but two canonical Catholics.
Okay.
From the Catholic Church's point of view, once a Catholic, always a Catholic.
Ah.
So a Catholic who has joined a Protestant church, as far as canon law is concerned, is simply a Catholic who is not meeting their Sunday Mass obligation.
Mm. Okay.
Right? Catholics are obligated to go to Mass every Sunday and confession and communion at least once a year. So here you have, you know, not a non-Catholic.
Yeah.
You have a Catholic, he's not doing what he's supposed to do, Catholic. And the church loves it when Catholics who are not doing what they're supposed to do turn around and do what they're supposed to do.
Mm.
And so one of the things that a Catholic is supposed to do is, if they contract a marriage, is to do it in the church. So they're not going to object to a Catholic marrying in the Catholic Church, and that's how they would see the situation. Now, from the point of view of Catholic theology, not Catholic canon law, this individual who's not practicing the faith is not properly disposed to receive a sacrament mm-hmm. worthily.
Mm,
right? Okay. They're not properly disposed to receive the sacrament worthily. Now, can you receive a sacrament validly if you don't receive it worthily? Depends on the sacrament. All right?
Okay.
But in the case of marriage, you can be validly married in the Catholic Church. That's a legal question.
Mm-hmm.
You can be validly married, even if you don't receive the sacrament worthily. So what are the implications of that? If you receive the sacrament of matrimony validly but unworthily, then you don't actually appropriate the grace that is intrinsic to the nature of the sacrament. So all sacraments convey grace,
mm-hmm.
and they do so, the church uses a fancy word here, ex opere operato, which means just by the proper maintenance of the ritual, grace is objectively on offer in a valid sacrament. But my ability to actually take that grace and make it work in my life to bring me to holiness requires my cooperation. Sacraments are not magic. They don't automatically make you holy. They give you the strength to become holy should you choose to do so. So the grace will be there
yeah.
when this Catholic is ready for it.
They'll
have a valid sacrament, but the grace won't actually be activated in their life until such time as they decide to reconcile with the church and do the things that they're supposed to do. But you go ahead and get married in the church. It's a valid sacrament. You're validly married. But let's come back and practice the Catholic faith so we can get all those graces flowing.
Amen. Brian, thanks so much for your text. Thanks for your good wishes regarding our 10th anniversary show, which is today here on EWTN's Call to Communion. If you would like to send us a text, you can do that right now. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Here's an email from Adam in Mississippi. Dr. Anders, recently you have been making appeals to Mediator Dei, the Pope Francis's document in answering certain questions. Towards the end of the first half of that work, the Pope mentions an attitude that he would like to correct, an attitude encapsulated by the phrase lex orandi, lex credendi, the law for prayer is the law of faith. He then proceeds to go into some reasoning about the relationship between faith and prayer, letting the rule for faith determine the rule for prayer and vice versa. Can you give us some background information about the attitude he wants to address and then the subsequent defense that follows that? Thanks, Adam in Mississippi.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate the question. So a couple clarifications. Mediator Dei is an encyclical of Pope Pius XII.
Pius XII.
Not of Pope Francis.
Thank you.
So it's considerably older. Although Pope Francis would like Mediator Dei, and, you know, it's part of the papal magisterium.
Okay.
Now, I don't have the encyclical in front of me right now, so I don't know the specific paragraph to which you're referring, but the principle lex orandi, lex credenti, is not an error to be corrected. It is a reality about the way religious consciousness is formed. And who was the fellow, Tom, that said, I don't care, let me write the songs of a nation, I don't care who writes its laws?
Oh, that's a good one.
Do you remember that quotation?
I've never heard that.
We got to look that one up.
Yeah.
Producer, can you look that one up for me?
He's on it.
Yeah.
He's on it.
I don't care, let me write the songs of a nation, I don't care who writes its laws. I don't remember the quotation. It was a famous quotation.
It wasn't Willie Nelson, was it?
It was not Willie Nelson.
All right.
Although,
all
you know,
right.
He writes our songs.
He does.
Really does, right? If you live in Alabama like I do, it's, you know, it's Hank Williams Jr., Country Boy Can Survive,
yes, sir.
Right? But But the principle there is makes a lot of sense. Like that you know, law ultimately reflects culture, and you know, you can pass all the laws you want, but you know, the culture has to be with you, or they're not enforceable,
mm-hmm.
right? And you know, culture is a much bigger question. I mean, how do you ultimately affect the valuing, the willing, the loving, the moral imagination, and in ways that are precognitive pre-rational or non-rational. And in the Catholic world, I mean, the reason why dogma is one category and ritual or sacraments or liturgy is another category
uh-huh.
is because what the liturgy and the sacraments do is they incarnate the dogma. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of abstract statements.
Mm,
right? You've got to find a way to get it down into the heart, to penetrate the personality and the moral imagination, to make the dogma livable. And that's why St. Thomas says we need sacraments, you know, because we actualize these things through our psychology, through how we think and feel and will and desire. And so, you know, you remember Supertramp, Tom? I know you know
sure.
Supertramp. You remember the Logical Song?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Logical Song went a little bit over the top, but the whole point of the Logical Song was, you're not going to move me by being logical. You know, you're going to move my heart through some other way.
Sure.
And Catholic faith is logical, is very logical, but you need the coordination of mind and heart to really transform the human person in a way that makes ultimately a moral difference.
Okay, very good. And we did get a little research on that. Rich came through for us. The author of that quote, Andrew Fletcher of Saltoun, a Scottish writer, politician, and patriot.
Well, there you go.
Andrew Fletcher.
Yep.
Now we all know. Thank you, Rich. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Here's another text that just came in from Sam. Why do the Eastern Orthodox speak of Roman Catholic legalism? What does that mean?
So, look, we like the Orthodox. Some of the Orthodox like us, and we go a long way, you know, and we need to go farther towards union and
yes.
reconciliation. And John Paul II's perspective was that East and West in Christendom are two lungs of a single body, and that to have a health in the body, you need both lungs. And so as Latin Catholics living in the West, our attitude towards Eastern Christians, whether they be Catholic or Orthodox, is that the Eastern patrimony has its own integrity, its own dignity, its own history, its own beauty that needs to be respected and preserved, and that patrimony needs to enrich the practice of Latin Rite Western Catholicism, even as the practice of Latin Rite Western Catholicism can enrich the East.
Hmm.
All right. And we're brothers in the faith. That's
yes.
that's the Catholic Church's attitude. Now, historically, have we as Latin Rite Catholics always lived that ethic? Well, no. Imagine that. Imagine that. And probably the most egregious example of not living that ethic was the Fourth Crusade, when Latin soldiers, Western Catholic soldiers, actually sacked the city of Constantinople and installed a Latin Rite patriarch, right? I mean, talk about an insult. That yeah. is the opposite of saying your tradition has mm-hmm. dignity and value and should be respected. It was yeah. a trampling all over the Eastern Rite patrimony. And from the point of view of the East, not only was the West not respecting the Eastern patrimony, but it was like, I don't know, it was, you know, it was like the townies getting run over by the rubes, you know, that the Latin church was essentially a church of converted barbarians who were, you know, barely out of Gothic Saxon paganism. And you know, our idea of education was to throw back to antiquity and to try to model ourselves in the ancient world, where it was, you know, kind of a Renaissance mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the East, they felt like, well, we didn't need a Renaissance because we never got rid of it. You know, we maintained the classical patrimony and this ideology of, you know, Rome having moved the seat of the empire from West to East, and it was the center of culture and education and all the rest of it. And so it was like, really, from their point of view, kind of a double insult. And that, probably more than anything else, more than any theological division, led to increasing hostility between the two. And that hostility still remains in some quarters. And so you do find modern Orthodox people who you know, a friend of mine is related to an Orthodox missionary in Albania. He's an American, but he moved to Albania to teach in an Albanian seminary. And he said to my buddy one time, he said, you know, some of my neighbors just don't know why they hate Latin Catholics so much.
Really?
Right. Meaning, like, hating Latin Catholics was so baked in to yeah. their particular cultural understanding of the division that, like, it was just, it, like, you know, well, you do anything you want in the world, but whatever you do, don't become a Latin Rite Catholic. You know, that sort of thing. I mean, I grew up in the Protestant church I grew up in. It was like that. It was like, do anything you want, but whatever you do, don't become a Catholic, you know? And if that's where your head is, well, then, you know, then you traffic in stereotypes and caricatures. And there are a couple of standard Eastern caricatures and stereotypes of the West. And one of them would be that we're logic-chopping rationalists. That's one caricature. The other one is that we're a bunch of legalists. And by contrast, the person who makes that statement likes to portray the East as a kind of mystical, spiritual tradition that's more about the heart than the head and is more in touch with the kind of mystical significance of the dogmas and doesn't reduce them to a kind of, you know, scholastic logic that kills the soul as they would understand it. So I really think it's a caricature. I mean, they have canon law.
Sure.
They have theology. They have those disciplines. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it is true that the discipline of canon law developed in directions in the West that were different from the East. And that does mean that there are occasions when, you know, the Latin church might come down hard with a legal ruling that where you don't find an analog in the East. Mm-hmm. Same thing's true the other way around, I might add. But there are places where, you know, we're going to draw a line in the sand where they don't. And is this also true that in terms of scholastic theology, the scholastic method and dialectic is a different theological method from the kind of textual commentary that would be more typical of, say, you know, Eastern patrological reflection. So, I mean, there are differences, and those differences in any kind of sort of cultural division can lend themselves to caricature and misstatement.
Yeah. And again, of course, as you stated, we're praying for unity.
Mm-hmm.
Unity all day long.
All day long.
That would be...
And twice on Sundays.
Thank you so much for your question. It is Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. We're not taking your calls today. We are taking your live texts. You can text the letters EWTN to 58177. We're going to get to some more of these questions in just a couple of moments. First, I want to share a very happy anniversary here. This is congratulations going out to Huntsville Catholic Radio, serving Huntsville, Texas. They are celebrating 21 years with EWTN. Congratulations to Raymond Scheel at KPIA in Huntsville, Texas, from your friends here at EWTN. And by the way, David, we just got a text from Pam. Pam says, right now, I have no question for you, but happy anniversary. I love your program. And I live EWTN. Thanks. God bless. Pam.
Well, thanks so much, Pam. I really appreciate that.
Isn't that nice?
That is very nice.
It is great to hear from all of our EWTN family. And this is a term that Mother Angelica coined many, many years ago. And we do not just, you know, talk the talk on using the word family. We really live it and we try to live it each and every day. So thank you, Pam, for all of your kind words. Do appreciate that. In a moment, we're going to come back with a fascinating question here from Coy in Oklahoma. We're also going to get a question from Dennis. And here's one from Kevin and Ted. Sounds like romper room. I'm naming off all. Oh, I see Ted. I see. Anyway, now I'm really dating myself. Call to Communion on this 10th anniversary program with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Called Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. We are doing a mailbag program today. Going to get to a lot of emails that we've received over the past couple of weeks. Also, we'll take your live texts. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. And if you're watching us on YouTube this afternoon, you can put a question in the comments box, and our social media person, Michael McCall, will handle that, and he'll get it to us here in the studio. Michael just sent us this one. This is from another person named Michael on YouTube. This Michael says, what is the main difference between Protestants and the Eastern Orthodox branches of Christianity? And we touched on this briefly before the break.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So, first of all, let's say something about what they have in common.
Okay.
All right. Well, you know, they have in common many of the standard Christological dogmas articulated by the councils of the first four centuries of the church, you know, the Trinity and the Incarnation and so forth. So, and you know, the scriptures, they have those things in common, as most Christians have those things in common. The other thing that they have in common is that they both reject the doctrine of the papacy as it's held and practiced in the Catholic Church. And that rejection of the papacy is an important point of commonality for the following reason. Like when I was growing up and, you know, and in the 80s and even in the early 90s, there was a time when you could find an evangelical Protestant, you know, he might have grown up Presbyterian or Baptist or Methodist or something, who suddenly becomes awakened to the appeal of liturgy and tradition. And for a while, it was really trendy for evangelicals who discovered liturgy to go become Anglicans. And what seems to me to have shifted in the world of evangelical Protestantism in the United States is that, well, Orthodoxy is the new Anglicanism, right? And there are lots of evangelicals who, when they get bit by the liturgy bug, and this is, you know, for a variety of reasons, some of them having to do with what's internal in Episcopalian politics in North America, they end up going for Orthodoxy, right? Well, why not the Catholic Church? Why not just, look, that's your kind of natural home as a Westerner. Why not the Catholic Church? And at least one of the reasons is, oh, anything but the Pope. Oh, anything but the Pope.
Wow.
You know? And the influence of, so there's an influence of Orthodoxy on Protestantism. There's also a Protestant influence on Orthodoxy, although the Orthodox probably wouldn't want to admit that, because they typically, like at the sort of global level, they're not big fans of the Protestant Reformation. Here's the influence that runs the other way. From the 16th century, Protestants have developed a polemic, an argument against the Roman Catholic Church by claiming that the Pope is the Antichrist and connecting the rise of the papacy to apocalyptic prophecy in the New Testament. And that was not something that was a big part of Orthodox polemics against Rome until after the Reformation. And in the last, say, 200 years especially, you find more of that kind of language among Orthodox critics of Catholicism as they have been influenced by Protestant polemics against Rome.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So there is some, you know, there is some interchange between those two traditions, but typically centered on the question of opposition to Rome, right?
Okay.
Now, but in terms of the differences, and this is, if you ask an Orthodox person what they think about Protestantism, typically they're going to reject many aspects of it. And one of the things that they will sometimes caricature Protestants as is they will say, well, Protestants and Catholics are all Westerners and they do theology in a Western way. And Protestantism is a Western heresy. And it's the fruit of the evils of Roman Catholicism. That would be kind of like an Orthodox caricature of the origins of the Protestant Reformation. They'll be like, hey, notice we never had a Protestant Reformation over here in the East, guys. That's your problem. You created that problem, you know? And so that's a very typical Orthodox line. But they would differ from the Orthodox on many of the things from which they differ from Catholics, excepting the papacy, of course, such as the nature and efficacy of the sacraments, the nature and efficacy of faith, how salvation works, the role of tradition. All of those things are places where Orthodox and Protestants would differ. The Protestants, you know, typically reject the primacy of tradition. They're going to reject the expanded canon of the Bible. They have the doctrine of justification by faith alone and total depravity. They don't practice the intercession of saints. So all of, they reject icons and religious imagery, all
not,
of those things.
Not to mention Our Lady.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Well, whereas all those things are part of the Orthodox patrimony. Yeah. Orthodox are big into icons. They're big into the intercession of the Theotokos, Our Lady. Of course, they believe in the efficacy of the sacraments. Mm-hmm. They believe in apostolic succession. Those are things that Protestants reject.
Okay. Appreciate that. Thanks so much, Michael, for your question via YouTube this afternoon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Matt just contacted us via YouTube. Matt says, when can one ask for the intercession of a deceased loved one? Sadly, we just lost our beloved priest very suddenly, but man, I still feel his presence during the Mass. Can we ask for his intercession?
Oh, have at it, buddy.
Yeah,
have at it.
Put him to work.
Put him to work. Absolutely, right away. Now, there are a few things you can't do.
Okay.
Your deceased priest cannot be raised to the level of an international cult, right? Meaning that, you know, throughout the Church Universal, he's publicly recognized and acclaimed as a saintly person whose intercession is powerful, such that his name would be included in the lectionary and remembered at Mass with a feast day. And
sure.
That level of recognition requires papal approval, right? And in the same way, even at the diocesan level, like your priest, your bishop is not going to suddenly declare, you know, like a diocesan feast in honor of Father so-and-so, where you know, there's a kind of public cult around his persona. There is a procedure for doing that, but, you just can't automatically do that. But at the level of private prayer, absolutely. No. And that's the way canonization happens, right? Mm. So when someone is, as we put it, elevated to the altar, when someone is publicly recognized as a saint by the Holy See, by the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, it's usually because that person's cult, that person's veneration, has begun in the hearts of the faithful. You know, so a pious movement begins of lay people or lay people and priests gathering around a particular revered individual, and they begin to seek and pray his intercession, and maybe they begin to see results. And so they go to their own bishop, and they go, we think Father Smith is in heaven, right, for these reasons, and we really want to promote his cause. And then the bishop says, well, you know, that's a worthy cause. Let's get to work. And he turns to the Holy See and gets permission, and they start the investigation. But it always starts with what you're doing, which is those private prayers offered by individuals. So have at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt, thanks for checking us out on YouTube this afternoon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here's that fascinating question I mentioned from Coy in Oklahoma. Hi, Dr. Andrews and Tom. I recently read that Catholic schools practiced segregation, especially before the 1960s. Is this true? Thanks for your show. I've learned so much. And that's again from Coy in Oklahoma.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. Yeah, that's true. And so, you know, Catholic institutions, you may not have known this, Tom, but did you know that Catholic institutions are made up of human beings?
I've heard rumors.
Yeah, and human beings are embedded in cultures.
Yeah.
And cultures can have huge blind spots and deficits to the natural law and to human dignity and justice that they can perhaps even seek to justify through spurious argument, right, to satisfy the status quo and to maintain the power structure and all the rest of it. So Catholics are human beings who are subject to prejudices and evils, and it is the job of the Church to correct that. And the history of Catholicism throughout the centuries is of the Church gradually, because it takes time, letting the logic of the redemption work through entire cultures until they're transformed. And let me give you an earlier example of that. So when Christianity spread in the West to the Celtic and the Saxon and the Frankish peoples, pagan populations, there were a lot of superstitions that those pagans practiced. Two in particular that I will mention are the trial by ordeal. And if you've ever seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you remember the humorous scene where Eric Idle comes forward and wants to burn a woman at the stake because she's a witch, and they end up coming up with a trial where they weigh her in a balance against a domestic duck. And the conclusion is if she weighs more than the duck, that she's a witch, and therefore she should be burned. And I won't go through the tortured logic that justified that, but you know the scene I'm talking about.
Oh, yes.
So while the scene was humorous, the practice was real. And they didn't typically put people in balances or, you know, or weights and measures and weigh them against ducks. But they would do things like throw them in water to see if they sank. Worse, they would sometimes submerge a limb in boiling oil and then study a wound to tell whether or not it festered.
Oh, man.
There were all kinds of things that they would do. And they had these arbitrary rules of interpretation that involve not turning your cell phone on during a live radio broadcast. I'm going to turn this off now.
Thank you.
And then they would determine the outcome of criminal cases based on those criteria. Well, that had nothing to do with Christianity, right? And that was a holdover from paganism. But it took a while for the church to eliminate the practice. And actually, in the 13th century, at the Council, the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, the church said, we forbid clerics, priests, to bless trial by ordeal. And that the enforcement of that canon actually led gradually to the elimination of the practice. Here's another piece of paganism that endured for a while, not as long as the 13th century. Belief in elves.
What?
Beliefs in elves and sprites and other, you know, fantastical, mythical creatures from the pagan past. The sorts of things that show up in fantasy literature today, once upon a time, were actually believed by people, you know, as an explanation for natural evils. And like your cattle get sick and you think, well, they must have been hit by elves or something.
Wow.
That was a real part of pagan culture. And there is a historian, I think her name is Karen Jolie or Jolette, something of that nature, who wrote a fascinating study a number of years ago on petitions to the church for the exorcism of elves. And so pagan people who believed in elves would go to their local priest and be like, can you come kick the elves out of my field?
Wow.
You know, and it took a while to work that out of the culture. And I mean, I could come up with so many more historical examples, but sometimes it takes centuries to work through this stuff. When the explorers discovered the New World and the native populations of North America, it raised theological questions about the status of these people ontologically. Are they members of the same human race that we are members of? Are they entitled to the same kind of protections under the law that the rest of us are entitled to? And Catholics, Europeans in the early modern period, did not yet have a doctrine of human rights. They had a doctrine of natural law, but they didn't have a doctrine of human rights per se.
Mm.
And it was actually in wrestling with the question, what to do with European interaction with indigenous peoples, that Catholic theologians evolved a doctrine of human rights out of the medieval doctrine of natural law. But it's one thing to evolve a doctrine. It's another thing for that doctrine to penetrate popular consciousness. And so Francisco de Vitoria, who was a theologian who was instrumental in the development of the theory of human rights, laid out the theory, and the rest of the world said, yawn, you know, we're going to go do what we want to do. And so slavery followed and other kinds of human rights abuses.
Yeah.
But the work had been done intellectually, and eventually, the logic of the position worked through. And so when it came time, say, for the UN to produce a universal declaration of human rights, who did they turn to write the statement but Jacques Maritain, a Catholic philosopher, right? That's just how these things roll. So, yes, did Catholic institutions engage in intrinsically immoral behavior? Yes, they certainly did.
Mm.
Do they now? Not that behavior. Not that one. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was a Catholic school in Birmingham, Alabama, that was the first school to desegregate.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think I've been told, and I could be wrong about this, but I believe it was St. Rose Academy in Birmingham.
How about that?
Was the first school to desegregate.
Beautiful. All right. Well, thank you so much for your question. Do appreciate that. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here's a question that we just received from Susan watching us on YouTube. I received the last sacrament while in a coma on the edge of dying. My sins were forgiven. Since I have miraculously survived, do my previous sins need to be confessed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure, and I don't know the answer to this question, to be honest with you. I'm not sure that specific situation is addressed in canon law. But I will tell you this, that the Code of Canon Law says that we are required to confess our known mortal sins at least once a year in kind and number, right? If you are conscious of mortal sin that was previously unconfessed, even if the sin has been absolved through the sacrament of anointing, I would say the safe bet is to bring it up the next time you go to confession. Because why would you want to have unconfessed mortal sin on your soul?
Why take a chance, right?
And so, I mean, we're going to have confidence that God forgives your sins. But the sacrament of confession is there for a reason, and there is a benefit to receiving it. So why not bring it up the next time you go to confession anyway? Like, what's the obstacle to doing
that? Yeah. Susan, thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Don't forget to check out EWTN Live with Father Mitch. That'll be tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television. Always a great program. Thomas is watching us and just sent us a text. Thomas says, is it possible that there are distant blood relatives of both Jesus and Mary?
Oh, intensely possible. Absolutely. Because, of course, they had blood relatives in their own day.
Sure.
And Jesus had blood relatives through the Blessed Virgin Mary's family. And, you know, I have no idea how many siblings and cousins and second cousins and third cousins twice removed she may have had and how many uncles and aunts and all the rest of it. And so, yeah, there's going to be genetic commonality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm not a geneticist, but I mean, at some level of remove, every human being on the planet is related.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of how distant. So, yeah, I mean, how far out do you want to go in the genetic tree? But, yeah, of course.
Okay. Appreciate that. Thomas, thanks for your text, and thanks for listening to EWTN Radio. Here's a question now from Dennis. What is the reason for putting a piece of the host into the chalice after consecration?
Yeah, that's an ancient tradition, and so is the tradition of mixing a little bit of water into the chalice. That's very, very old. Man, that goes back to apostolic times.
Really?
And the thing about traditions like that is that we do them because they've always been done. And if you ask a liturgist, why does the church do it that way? You will get someone's creative explanation, right? You will have an explanation that's, oh, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, was that the original explanation or is that just a nice sounding justification? You know, is that a post hoc rationalization of a practice whose origins are lost to the sands of time? And you know, you will hear things like, well, you know, mixing the water and the wine, it represents the commingling of Christ's divinity and his humanity, for example. Or, you know, you could potentially argue, like, placing the host in the chalice. I mean, the host, we understand that the sacraments are more than signs, they're more than symbols, but they are also symbols. They're symbols that convey what they communicate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have the real presence of Christ, but represented through a sign. And so not at the substantial level, but at the sign level, the consecrated host represents Christ's body, the consecrated chalice represents his blood, even though we know the real presence is equally present in both of them. So you could see there is a sign value in commingling them to remind us that the body and blood of Christ are not in fact separated. Like, this is the resurrected Christ who's present, all right? Not, if you really had his body here and his blood there, he'd be dead.
Right.
Right. That's why we do the double consecration, to memorialize his actual death. But we can also remind ourselves that he's dead no more. You know, we say that the Eucharist is the memorial of his death and his resurrection, which is the reuniting of body and blood.
Yes, indeed.
But you could probably spin out some other creative explanations, too, and they'd be as good as the next guy since, like I said, some of these things are lost in the sands of time.
Reminds me of Fiddler on the Roof. Tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I had a graduate advisor, a graduate professor, who he was an evangelical Christian fellow, actually, but his academic specialty was the religions of India. And he knew all their sacred texts, like, you know, back of his hand. But he loved to do ethnographic work. And so he said he would often watch local people perform pujas and sacrifices, and he would always ask them, well, why do you do it that way? And he knew what the texts said,
yeah,
but he wanted to hear what they would say. And their answer would always be, oh, this is our tradition so to do, which is another way of saying, well, this is what the last guy did, you know? And Christians do that too, of course.
Sure.
You know, my dad was growing up a Baptist in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and he used to tell me that one thing that irked him was that they would take attendance in Sunday school every week, and then they would read the attendance numbers from the pulpit as if that was, like, the most important news that you could possibly hear. You know, oh, we had, you know, 352 people in Sunday school. Isn't that wonderful? And it was like he could never figure out the rationale. Like, why are we taking attendance and reading it from the pulpit? And, like, the answer was, this is our tradition so to do. you know.
And there it is.
And Catholics do the same thing.
There it is. Called to Communion here on EWTN. Just wanted to let you know, we were talking earlier about EWTN Live with Father Mitch, and his guest tomorrow will be Cardinal Burke.
How about that?
Cardinal Leo Burke will be along with Father Mitch tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television. So Rosa is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Rosa says, my daughter is divorced but was previously married by the church, and she wants to date someone now. I'm not happy about this. How can I talk to her about the church not permitting that?
Okay, so let's clarify a couple points.
Yep.
First of all, you didn't mention whether or not she has received an annulment.
Ah.
That makes all the difference in the world. So if she was validly married in the church and is now civilly divorced, mm-hmm. and she wants to contract another relationship, the thing for her to do is apply for an annulment if she hasn't done so.
Yeah.
If she receives the annulment, if it's granted, then that is the church saying you were never married. That's okay. What an annulment means. You
All
were
right.
never married. That was not a valid marriage for whatever reason. And there are reasons why it might be considered invalid.
Okay.
And then, like, this is not a discussion. So that's the first thing to do. So let's say either A, doesn't want to apply for the annulment, B, has applied for the annulment and was turned down, C, has applied for the annulment and hasn't gone through yet. Okay. Well, then does that mean that she absolutely under no circumstance could ever date? Well, this now is more like a matter of prudence, okay? And you know, I'd say you're in a subjectively different position if, you know, so you go to your parish priest and he's filed the paperwork for you and the annulment is in process and he says, you know, I've seen this before. Your situation, it looks like to me, I would you know, give it 6 months and this thing's going to be granted. I still wouldn't think it'd be a good idea to date, but that's a slightly different situation. But I think she ought to be forthcoming with anybody she goes out with and say, look, I'm in the process of an annulment. So I'm technically still married as a Catholic. And so this is not, this relationship, we're having pizza tonight. Okay, you understand what I'm saying, bud? All right. This is not yet what I would call romance. You know, this is a friendly outing among adults, you know, who are lonely and want to get to know one another. But like we are not tending to marriage here or anything else. Right. Until I know that that's on the table.
Very
right.
Good.
Now, the last question is, how do you communicate this?
Yeah,
well, that's a whole nother can of worms.
Oh, yeah.
Because in my experience, the adult children of Catholic parents already know everything that they think mom and dad is going to say. And they have already worked out their response ahead of time to what mom and dad are going to say.
Yep.
And they don't care a whole bunch what mom and dad are going to say. And saying it sometimes induces the behavior you're trying to stop. So you have to ask yourself the question, is she likely to listen to anyone? And if so, are you the person she's most likely to listen to and be honest? Because generally it ain't mom.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
There you go, Rosa. Thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Probably going to close with this question from Kevin. Dr. Anders, if we're not out there feeding the poor, what are other charitable works that we can do? Would church donations and praying for our enemies fall under that category? And what else do you suggest? Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, so go look up the corporal and spiritual works of mercy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And because there's all kinds of merciful things you can be involved in. You know, on the corporal work of mercy side, and forgive me, I know I'm going to miss some. I haven't reviewed the whole list recently in my head. But you can, of course, give food to the hungry, drink to the thirsty, clothing to the naked, shelter to the homeless. You can visit the sick and the imprisoned. What else am I missing, Tom?
Well, you could certainly get involved with
the corporal work of mercy. I'm trying to
okay.
go down the list.
Oh, okay.
Have I missed any corporal works?
I don't think so.
Well, that's a pretty good list of corporal
it
works.
It is.
Okay.
It is.
And of course, you can do that directly.
Yeah.
But you can also do it through agencies. So, you know, if you support Catholic Social Services in your jurisdiction or Catholic Relief Services or an addiction center or a homeless shelter, I mean, any of those things, Catholic Family Services, Jesus says if you give a cup of cold water, you don't lose your reward. So, you know, making financial contributions to those kind of ministries is a way of vicariously participating. On the spiritual work of mercy side, you can instruct the ignorant, you can comfort the afflicted, you can pray, you can counsel. You can pray for the living and the dead. You can have masses said. Anything you do in the spiritual domain to the benefit of another person is a spiritual work of mercy. And so, you know, some people are constrained either financially or physically or psychologically in what they can do, but everyone can do something.
Everybody can do something. Absolutely. We could not get to Samuel's text, and it would take a little bit of time to unpack that. So, Samuel, please contact us on a future show. Perhaps tomorrow will be the day. Dr. David Andrews, a very happy anniversary to you, my friend. Let's pray for the next 10.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. Happy anniversary to you, too. Let's pray for another 10.
You got it. Don't forget to join us tomorrow at the same time. We do this program 5 days a week, Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Check out the podcast anytime by going to EWTN.com. Click on the radio box and then look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow. We'll start the next 10 right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a great one. God bless.